This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 26th. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Verna Avery Brown. Coming up...
The compound is very clearly marked. The location has been notified since the beginning. It has been reminded to the conflicting parties after the incident and again. So today is, again, a very big blow.
The U.S. bombs the Red Cross in Kabul again. Anti-terror legislation from D.C. to New Delhi, and a Pakistani journalist brutally beaten in New York City. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush signed the anti-terrorism bill into law today, the day after the bill was passed by the Senate 98-1, with Senator Russ Feingold the lone dissenter. Ellen Ratner reports from Washington.
The new laws allow the government to detain suspected immigrants for 7 days, widen the definition of domestic terrorists to possibly include political protesters, and reduce judicial oversight of wiretaps and other information gathering technology while increasing governmental surveillance ability. Bush said that intelligence and law enforcement agencies will now be able to monitor all forms of communications.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the Internet, and cell phones.
Congress added certain safeguards to the Bush administration's plan, including attaching a sunset clause to some of the more controversial measures, which places a time limit of 4 years on the new laws. At the White House, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner.
Evidence of anthrax contamination has been found today at the CIA and at a warehouse that screens mail headed for the Supreme Court. Meantime, Akbar Rafsanjani, the chief advisor to Iran's supreme leader, said the United States is paying the price for supplying anthrax to Iraq. And officials here in the United States continue to negotiate the purchase of anti-anthrax antibiotics. Katja Mester is in Washington.
Critics of the federal government's $183 million deal with Bayer to buy the anti-anthrax drug Cipro say the federal government is overpaying the drug company. Tommy Thompson, the Health and Human Services Secretary, negotiated an agreement to purchase Cipro at 95 cents per pill, even though the agency already purchases the drug for 43 cents per pill under a federal program. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader denounced the deal, saying the double price structure should not be tolerated. Consumer groups wonder why there remains no serious discussion to purchase drugs from countries like India, which has been manufacturing the drug cheaply for years. India announced this week it is willing to donate to the United States $1 million of the anti-anthrax drug. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Katja Mester.
Police arrested 17 at a protest for peace in Connecticut. Melinda Tuhus was there.
About 200 people gathered in Hartford's main park for a rally against the U.S. war in Afghanistan. They called for the arrest and trial of those responsible for the terrorist attacks on the U.S., not for the bombing of another country with inevitable civilian casualties. Then the group set off through the streets of downtown Hartford at rush hour. Police brought in reinforcements and moved people onto the sidewalk. Then police ordered the marchers to disperse. When people insisted on their right to be on the sidewalk, police moved in and arbitrarily pulled people out of the front line, and several were beaten and pepper sprayed. There was no indication of any violence coming from the protesters. 16 people were arrested and face a variety of charges, from disorderly conduct to inciting to riot. In Hartford, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
The Justice Department told the city of Cincinnati that it should make sweeping policy changes to prevent the unreasonable use of police force. A report issued by the department called the police department's use of force policy ambiguous, called for a blanket prohibition of the deadly chokehold, and recommended reviews of excessive force be conducted by an outside agency that's adequately funded and empowered to investigate serious allegations of police misconduct. Edgar Pillows is a writer and community activist in Cincinnati.
The report vindicated what critics of the police have been saying for some time. And as a matter of fact, Black Police Union, the Sentinels, did a report in 1999 that practically duplicates what the feds did just recently.
All 15 suspects killed by police in Cincinnati since 1995 have been Black. The city could face legal sanctions if they do not institute the reforms. However, the police chief says many of the policy changes are already being enacted. The Bush administration announced that it will eliminate an environmental regulation on the mining of gold, silver, copper, and lead that went into effect the day that former President Clinton left office. Nell Geiser reports.
The Bush administration announced yesterday that it will eliminate an environmental regulation on the mining of gold, silver, copper, and lead, which went into effect the day Clinton left office. Under the old policy, the Interior Secretary could veto hard rock mining operations, which were determined to cause substantial, irreparable harm. Bush's action takes away that veto power. The move follows Bush administration reversals of sweeping forest protections and limits on the level of arsenic in drinking water. Along with the change in policy, the administration announced a legal opinion that gives the go-ahead for an open-pit gold mine on sacred land of the Quechan Nation in California. Former Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt prevented Glamis Gold Limited of Nevada from mining on the land because the operation would cause undue impairment. Representatives of the Quechan people called the reversing of Babbitt's decision an outrage and purely a political move. Environmental groups threatened legal action following the announcement yesterday. They say the move will lead to groundwater pollution and prohibit citizens from challenging the most harmful mines. Roger Flynn is the director of the Boulder, Colorado-based Western Mining Action Project.
Secretary Norton's decision yesterday will only allow the Interior Department to say no if a mine would violate, let's say, a water quality standard. The problem is, we never know that the mine's going to violate the water quality standard until the mine's already in, the water's already polluted, and those Indian sacred sites, for example, are long blown up.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
U.S. bombs rained down on food warehouses of the International Red Cross again today. A spokesperson for the International Aid Agency told reporters that huge explosions hit three warehouses at 11:30 a.m. Kabul time, setting fire to needed food supplies. Jeremy Scahill has more.
The Bush administration has made it clear it will bomb Afghanistan any day it wishes. So it came as no surprise that cities and villages across the country were pounded throughout the day, a Muslim holy day. According to news reports out of the country, U.S. warplanes bombed a crowded bus carrying Friday worshipers, while three children were reported killed in overnight bombings, two of them sisters. They now join the estimated hundreds of civilians killed by Washington's attacks over the last 3 weeks. This afternoon, U.S. missiles once again bombed a Red Cross compound, the second attack on the facility in 10 days.
We don't know. We are somehow appalled by what happened.
Mario Muras is the spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Pakistan. He says the buildings bombed by the U.S. were warehouses, storing food and medical supplies that were being provided to disabled people and widows.
The compound is very clearly marked. The location has been notified since the beginning. It has been reminded to the conflicting parties after the incident and again. So today is, again, a very big blow.
The Red Cross is saying today its local staff in Afghanistan are now terrified, and there are serious questions about whether they'll be able to continue their humanitarian efforts on the ground. Al Jazeera TV is broadcasting images of the compound in flames. But today at the Pentagon, Rear Admiral John Stufflebeam said he had no information on the attack.
I've heard a report that the possibility of a Red Cross warehouse was damaged in the vicinity of one that had previously been struck. But I don't have any other information on that. I don't know if it was damaged by Taliban forces or anyone else. So I'm sorry, I just don't have anything for you on that.
Meanwhile, the British government announced today it's sending 200 elite commandos to the region to participate in any ground operations in Afghanistan. They will join the thousands of U.S. Special Operation Forces already making incursions into the country. The move was announced today by the British Armed Forces Minister, Adam Ingram.
We have rightly made a commitment to our closest ally, the United States, to stand shoulder to shoulder with them, and we are determined to do just that.
But with the U.S. now regularly using deadly cluster bombs, the British defense minister was forced on the defensive today in the British Parliament by Liberal Democrat Paul Keech.
Given that these bombs can cause not only a danger to civilians, but also to our own forces who then may occupy areas where they've been used, can the minister give us an assurance today that we will not deploy cluster bombs? And can he assess as to whether it would be possible for the Americans to use an alternative weapon instead of using cluster bombs?
The minister's answer? Cluster bombs are necessary in the war on terrorism. Despite the growing outcry around the world and the mounting civilian death toll in Afghanistan, the Pentagon says it will continue to attack with cluster bombs and all other weapons the Bush administration wishes to use. Today's attack on the Red Cross warehouses in Kabul means desperately needed aid was destroyed, making the humanitarian situation on the ground all the more dire. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
U.S. bombs hit Red Cross warehouses in Kabul on October 16th as well. The Red Cross said those warehouses had essential food supplies, tents, tarps, blankets, and other aid supplies intended for the impoverished people of Kabul. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Martha Baskin reports the Red Cross bombing could create an unprecedented humanitarian disaster.
When U.S. and British-led bombing struck a Red Cross warehouse in Kabul 10 days ago, a third of the wheat stored for the winter was destroyed. The next day, a coalition of humanitarian relief organizations, among them Oxfam International, Christian Aid, and Islamic Relief, began calling for a humanitarian pause in the bombing. Their request has so far been denied. A 1,000-pound bomb was dropped on a center for the elderly. Bombs have exploded in residential areas, hospitals, fuel depots, a radio station, and destroyed hundreds of roads. Cluster bombs forced 70% of the city of Herat to flee in terror, according to the UN early this week.
Things are getting worse and worse. People are saying that there's not a window, there's not a door standing in some parts of the country.
Sam Barrett, with Oxfam International on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border.
Speaking to people yesterday who fled Kandahar because of the bombing, they were saying that there's virtually no food left in the town. I spoke to someone from Bamiyan yesterday who was saying that they're relying on eating roots and plants and leaves that they could find.
The lives of more than 7 million people are at stake in this war-ravaged country. Snow is already reported in mountainous areas. If food and water cannot be delivered, deaths from starvation, drought, cold, and disease are guaranteed. Again, Sam Barrett.
It's not just the bombing, it's all the military action that is making it very hard for humanitarian aid agencies who are trying to help the people. I mean, I was talking to some truckers yesterday, and they're saying, even if you give me the whole of Pakistan, I'm not going to take food into this country because I'm simply too scared.
Delivery of the aid is one of the most pressing problems. When the Taliban emerged in 1994, they had the support of the powerful truck mafia because they were able to establish order in a country that had sunk into virtual disintegration. Bandits and factions within the Northern Alliance ruled, making safe road travel all but impossible. The Taliban set up a one-toll system, patrolled the highway from Pakistan, and restored what little commerce there was. With truckers again afraid to travel the roads, delivering aid has become almost impossible. Jo Marie Greisgraber, Oxfam's policy director in Washington.
Our real concern right now is that with winter coming in about 3 weeks and with Ramadan coming in just about the same length of time, we don't have much of a window of opportunity to make these deliveries. So we have to have some greater domestic tranquility, some kind of peace, so that truck drivers are not terrified to drive.
Greisgraber reports that persistent and aggressive bombing have emptied the larger cities, creating what she describes as unrest, insecurity, and terror. People are attempting to flee to their home villages or to the borders to try and escape the blitz of day and nighttime bombing. Small communities in the country's central highlands are already experiencing near starvation. Like many humanitarian aid organizations who gain reputations for specialties, Oxfam is known for its ability to deliver clean water. But in mountainous Afghanistan, water tunnels that run through mountains are now stashed with grenades and anti-tank mines for safekeeping. The UN's World Food Program confirms that its biggest obstacle remains access to Afghanistan's people due to insecurity and a shortage of trucks and fuel. As a last resort, it is considering airdropping food by mid-November. As for winning the hearts and minds of the people, as the Pentagon describes its campaign in Afghanistan, veteran war correspondent Eric Margolis and author of War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet, disagrees.
Every day that America stays in Afghanistan, it will build lifetime enemies. America has no business there. It needs to get in, and if it can't find bin Laden, it needs to get out. The worst thing it could do is become a permanent colonizing power.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
The Taliban executed a commander of the exiled opposition today after he crossed into Afghanistan. Abdul Haq, a veteran Mujahideen warrior who fought the Soviet occupation, was leading efforts to forge a broad opposition alliance around deposed King Zahir Shah to rule the country if the Taliban were toppled. He also opposed the U.S. bombing campaign.
Just to by firing a few rockets and bombing a few places in Afghanistan, it will not stop any terrorist activity in this country. And it will make people upset and angry, especially if some civilians get hurt and civilians get killed, their houses get destroyed. They will all go support Taliban, although their system is going down. In that way, they will increase the support and some kind of a popularity for Taliban.
Commander Abdul Haq speaking just days before his execution. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Fariba Nawa is in Peshawar on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. She says Haq's killing is a blow against peace.
He was a mediator, basically, between the Taliban, the Northern Alliance, as well as the U.S. And he was a plan in the future of Afghanistan in reinstalling the former King Zahir Shah. With him gone, it's a major blow. And the Taliban have basically murdered major leaders in this campaign, one being Ahmad Shah Massoud and now Abdul Haq. So it's a very sad day for everyone who has been trying to resolve the issue. Abdul Haq was opposed to U.S. strikes in Afghanistan. He spoke out against it many times. He was trying to seek a peaceful solution. He had gone into Afghanistan reportedly to discuss the situation with Taliban, moderate Taliban, who had contacted him. Some believe that he was called to Afghanistan by Taliban, who betrayed him and then captured him. I think the mood in Peshawar is sort of, it's not so much of shock. I think people are starting to lose hope that this war is going to end soon. People are getting ready for a long haul. And I'm staying with a family that are, they're basically news junkies. They're attached to the radio and the television all day long. They listen to Pashto, Farsi, English, you name it. And the emotions that are expressed in this family, I think, are very reflective of other refugees in this city. Basically, you know, the mother of six children, she's been crying all day because she felt that Abdul Haq was one of our last options. Especially because he was one of the few Pashtuns in the Northern Alliance or in the post-Taliban government. So I think there's great sadness here right now.
Correspondent Fariba Nawa is in Peshawar, Pakistan. Today, President Bush signed the Patriot Act, granting greatly expanded powers to police in the name of fighting terrorism. In a similar move, the Indian government has passed the Prevention of Terrorism Ordinance. It gives draconian powers to police, and civil liberties groups have warned that the law blatantly violates democratic rights and civil liberties. The new ordinance is a resurrection of an anti-terrorism law passed in the 1970s, which was repealed a few years ago after massive public protest. This ordinance goes even further than the previous law, mandating punishment for the failure to impart information about terrorist acts. As Sputnik Columbia reports, this latest development will limit the scope of democratic protest in India.
September the 11th has proved to be a watershed in more ways than one. The anti-terrorism ordinance that has been signed by the president, though not yet passed in parliament, is even more draconian than its previous avatar. This despite several studies that show that anti-terrorism legislation has been widely misused in the past and has had no impact to speak of on armed groups operating in various parts of the country. Lawyer Madhu Mehra says Washington's so-called war against terror has given New Delhi the perfect pretext.
The reason why it has come in and come in so quickly is partly because of the global legitimacy that has been attached to clamping down on whatever is perceived as terrorism. So given the U.S. war on Afghanistan, it's created a kind of a situation which has legitimized other countries, particularly South Asia, because we've had a lot of armed aggression here. So it's very difficult to look at this ordinance outside of this global situation that's happened, which has suddenly made terrorism seem unique.
The new ordinance leaves the definition of a terrorist act extremely vague. Misuse, say civil liberties groups, is literally written into its provisions.
The period of detention is 3 months, of anyone who's suspected to be a terrorist. The definition,
without access to a lawyer?
Without access to a lawyer, without charges being framed. It's a very broad definition of terrorism that this act gives. Includes several things. So presumably the number of people who would be susceptible to prosecution under this would be a very vast number of people.
So anything that the government basically feels is threatening to it can be brought under the purview of this anti-terrorism
law. Yes, which is precisely why laws like this have been opposed by civil liberties groups. In this situation where such a broad exception is made for activities which are very subjective in definition, then the citizen, is made very, very vulnerable.
Already, students have been detained and harassed for distributing anti-war leaflets. Sunil Kumar, secretary of the Democratic Students' Union, has grim memories of police custody.
पर्चे बांट रहे थे उस समय 10:30 बजे पुलिस वाले आए और बिना कुछ बोले हम लोगों को जिप्सी में बंद कर लिया.
We were distributing leaflets when suddenly the cops came and bundled us into a gypsy without saying a word. They took us to the detention center and started beating us with sticks, saying we were terrorists. You're distributing leaflets, they said, and causing trouble. They kept on accusing us of having links with terrorists and foreign groups that were getting money from outside. We were subjected to a lot of mental torture.
Yet India's home minister has openly praised the destruction 9 years ago of the Babri Mosque in northern India, calling it a continuation of the freedom struggle. When India's Christian minority was being hounded by Hindu fundamentalists not so long ago, the Prime Minister could only talk about the problem of conversions to Christianity, says Rona Wilson, president of the Democratic Students' Union.
So all these statements were never taken as sedition by any seat of law in this country. But when our activists are issuing pamphlets that too opposing this war, calling it as an anti-people war, and also condemning at the same time the terrorist act that was done, we are being branded as anti-nationals. We are being branded as fomenting communalism.
Lawyer Madhu Mehra feels the U.S. war against Afghanistan is distracting the media from paying enough attention to such issues. Fuzzy images of smart bombs dropping on a ruined nation are apparently visually more appealing, she says. But the new law will further limit the scope of action of civil society.
If you're going to pick up people and arrest them and there's going to be a pattern of state repression like that, how much free space is there going to be for public debate on issues like this? Especially now since terrorism has become a holy cow. We can't debate it anymore. So there is the issue of censorship, really. That are you safe? Do you really want to be debating issues that might have dire consequences for you?
Sputnik Kilambi in New Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Stories of serious hate crimes against those perceived as Arab, Muslim, or Middle Eastern continue to emerge across the United States. A Pakistani journalist living in Brooklyn is one of the latest victims of the post-September 11th backlash, viciously beaten for the way he was seen by his attackers. Robert Knight has more from New York City.
Late Sunday night, Haider Rizvi, an international journalist of Pakistani heritage and a resident of Brooklyn's Park Slope community, was beaten, kicked, and rendered unconscious and toothless at a neighborhood store by three men who claimed he looked like Osama bin Laden. Rizvi's assault has been declared a hate crime by the New York Police Department, the third such to end in a physical attack, and one of more than 200 bias incidents to occur since September 11th. Already in 6 weeks, more than half the number of bias incidents reported in all of the year 2000. Rizvi is still suffering pain and fever, but improving somewhat. He spoke with your reporter about the events of late last Sunday night in front of a Pakistani-owned Brooklyn convenience store.
It was late night, like about 3 o'clock, and I went there to buy cigarettes. The name of the grocery store is S&S. There were three guys standing outside the grocery store because after midnight they close the main door and the transaction takes place through the window. So one of them looked at me and said, "You look like Osama bin Laden. Are you from Pakistan?" I said, "Originally, yes." I wanted to say yes, and then I wanted to add that I live in Brooklyn and I'm a Brooklynite. But he didn't let me go there and started kicking and punching. So I fell down on the floor and fell unconscious. And later the grocery store worker came out and gave me first aid. because I was bleeding. And then we called some friends, and the cops came. And that's how it, and they took me in an ambulance to Methodist Hospital.
Did you get a good look at the assailants?
My interaction with them lasted for less than a minute, so I would describe them as white Hispanics, but I'm not sure. But these kicks were very surgical, very trained.
Now, what happened and how were you treated when you got to the hospital?
They had no dentist or dental surgeon over there at that point, so they just gave me an injection to relieve the pain. And I had to wait for another day to go there. So I had to live with pain for more than 2 days until I went to another dentist in Midtown Manhattan who removed the tooth.
Why do you think they singled you out?
I have a very short beard and I have a brown face. And my guess is the way media is portraying the faces of the people in that region, which I call Central Asia and South Asia, they all look alike.
Yeah, and another irony is that you became this weekend the subject of just the kinds of attacks that you've been documenting as an international reporter. Where is some of your work?
Lately, I've been writing for the Indo-Asian News Service, which feeds to more than 70 newspapers in the Gulf region and South Asian region.
Haider, you've served as a reporter in some of the more dangerous parts of the world, the Gulf and Indo-Asian subcontinent, and now Brooklyn, New York, America.
Well, I was a student back in Pakistan in the 1990s, and the Cold War was at its peak. The Islamic fundamentalists were being backed by our government here, and I suffered several times beating at the hands of Islamic fundamentalists over there. And now I'm a reporter in New York City, and I'm being beaten because I'm from that region, and that's so ironic.
Pakistani heritage journalist Haider Rizvi rendered unconscious in a Sunday night bias beating in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Today, the police investigation and his own recovery are ongoing. In New York, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robert Knight.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on 4 continents and in 14 states are on strike against the Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. Free Speech Radio News depends on listeners like you. If you value the independent reporting you hear on Free Speech Radio News, you need to support it. To find out how, you can visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Jade Padgett-Seekins is the technical producer. Thanks to Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes for web support. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Verna Avery Brown. Thanks for listening. Please tune in again next week.